Hi, I'm Frances Anderton and this is DNA. There's a design duo that is breathing new life into an old Masonic lodge in Highland Park.
If there's a philosophy behind what we do, it relates to kind of everyday life and accessibility and having people feel comfortable in the space, which also includes elements of delight and surprise.
Meet Rebecca Rudolph and Catherine Johnson and learn about their very provocative name coming up later in the show. First, though, yes, you know that sound. That's right. The boys in blue are in the World Series for the first time in almost 30 years. The excitement is high, as are the ticket prices, which are now selling for upwards of $1,000. And Dodger Stadium is festooned in World Series branded decorations in readiness for the first game, which starts in a few hours. Good luck if you're sitting in traffic right near the stadium. Dodger Stadium in Chavez Ravine is now an icon of mid-century Los Angeles, but its birth was a painful one, and the battles over its construction tore Angelenos apart, even as the stadium now brings communities together. Gerald Poder is a professor of history at Lawrence University in Appleton, Wisconsin, and he studied the history of Dodger Stadium in a book published this year called City of Dreams, Dodger Stadium and the Birth of Modern Los Angeles. Hello, Gerald.
Hello, Frances.
How did Dodger Stadium come to represent the birth of modern Los Angeles?
Well, it's an interesting story, and it actually starts in New York City, of course, because the Dodgers moved to Los Angeles from New York in 1957, and a lot of history has been written about that move, and that move is still very controversial. Dodger Stadium, in many ways, represented the birth of a modern Los Angeles, and the reason I say that is, in 1957, if you had gone to downtown Los Angeles and walked around after 5 o'clock, you wouldn't have found very many people, or you wouldn't have found very many white middle-class people, because downtown Los Angeles in 1957 was what I call a work and flee zone. You worked during the day, and then you drove out to the peripheries or to the suburbs in your car at night. And the reason Dodger Stadium, I think, is so important is that city fathers or the city downtown establishment wanted Dodger Stadium to be the first piece in the building of a modern, world-class downtown Los Angeles that would be in keeping and would be commensurate with the status and the power that the city was starting to amass politically, economically, and especially culturally after World War II.
Now, this coincided, however, with the massive urban renewal that took place at Bunker Hill, also part of the same vision. Are you saying they coincided and it was the same folks that were behind all this?
Well, I think they overlapped. Bunker Hill and Dodger Stadium proceeded along parallel tracks, and obviously the Bunker Hill renovation took a lot longer than Dodger Stadium, which was completed in 1962. The Bunker Hill redevelopment project went on for decades, but I think the same people supported it and the same people opposed it.
So tell us how Walter O'Malley, a New Yorker, a Brooklynite through and through, decides to up sticks and move west with his team to Los Angeles.
Well, for many years in New York, Walter O'Malley was trying to build a new stadium. Today, we have historical memories of Ebbets Field, which are somewhat romanticized.
Ebbets Field being the stadium where the Dodgers played.
The Brooklyn Dodgers played. It was a cramped stadium. It was a dirty stadium. It featured poles, so obstructed views. It had very little parking. It was not particularly accessible. And it was a stadium built in the 19-teens, and by the 1950s, O'Malley wanted a modern stadium. He was willing to build the stadium on his own in New York, but he needed help acquiring the land. He received a very little assistance in New York, and then he set his sights on Los Angeles, or Los Angeles set its sights on him, because Los Angeles in the 1950s is a very ambitious city, and they set their sights on getting the Dodgers to move to Los Angeles. And the way they do that is they offer O'Malley exactly what New York would not offer him, which is assistance in obtaining land on which to build his own stadium. And that land, of course, was the Chavez Ravine area just adjacent to downtown. And one of the things that struck me in researching this book is how little O'Malley knew about Los Angeles in 1957. When he announced the move, he had only been to Los Angeles three times in his life for a total of less than 10 days. He needed a map to get to Chavez Ravine.
In his ignorance, he did not know what a contested site Chavez Ravine had already become.
Exactly. He did not know the history of the area. What happens is in May 1957, on one of his visits to L.A., they take him up in a helicopter, and he's flying around over Los Angeles, and he immediately looks at Chavez Ravine, which is this large expanse of almost empty land right next to downtown L.A. He says, that's where I want to build my stadium. So the deal is cut. The contract is agreed upon, where he was going to get 315 acres of land in Chavez Ravine that the city already owned. But what he didn't know is that a number of years previous, that had been the site of a public housing project at Chavez Ravine in a community of Mexican Americans that was very traditional and had been at the Chavez Ravine area for many years. To build this public housing project in the early 50s, most of the residents of Chavez Ravine were either bought out or essentially evicted. So most of the Chavez Ravine families by the early 50s are gone from that area, and then they cancel the public housing project.
Which I'm going to interject and just say was designed by the famed mid-century modernist architect Richard Neutra.
Yes. Neutra and Robert Alexander planned a modernist housing experiment there with a mix of high-rise and low-rise buildings. They were really looking to create a community that would replicate the traditional community at Chavez Ravine that they were replacing. But as so often is the case in urban renewal projects, the tenants were told in the early 1950s that they would have the first opportunity to move back once the housing projects were constructed. But here, the projects were not constructed, and the land lay essentially empty for 4 or 5 years, except for a number of Chavez Ravine residents who refused to move. So when O'Malley flew over it in May 1957, if he looked closely, he would have seen that there were probably about 15 or 20 families left, 15 or 20 homes that were still occupied. But if the Neutra projects had been built, they certainly would have been very interesting architecturally.
But what does come to pass is that there's a very interesting political alliance that supports O'Malley's bid.
It is a very interesting alliance. You would expect perhaps conservatives, let's say, to support this project, have no problem with evicting Mexican Americans from Chavez Ravine, and you would expect liberals to say, oh, this is a terrible thing, we oppose it. Well, it actually was more complicated than that, because the leading proponents of the Dodger Stadium project were a liberal, Rosalind Wyman, who was a city council woman at the time, a liberal, and Norris Paulson, who was a conservative Republican. He was the mayor of Los Angeles at the time. And then on the other side, the leading opponents of the Dodger Stadium contract and Dodger Stadium project were a liberal Democrat, Edward Roybal, whose name I'm sure is familiar to many Angelenos. He was a councilman at the time and went on to become a congressman, and he was against it. And so was a conservative Republican named John Holland, who was a city councilman for many years. He represented the Echo Park District, small homeowners, very conservative, didn't like taxpayer resources being used to help a private entrepreneur. He was against what he would probably have called, he would have called it something different, but today he would say, this is crony capitalism. This is a private entrepreneur getting public benefits. In other words, O'Malley was going to have access to this land. The actual land deal was a trade of properties. O'Malley owned a property called Wrigley Field, not the one in Chicago, the one in Los Angeles. And he owned this property, and it was going to be traded to the city of Los Angeles for Chavez Ravine.
Where was Wrigley Field in Los Angeles?
Wrigley Field was in South Central, I guess what now is South Central Los Angeles. And the problem with Wrigley Field, some said, well, why not build a stadium there? They just didn't have enough land. It was very, very cramped. So the politics here are very interesting. So you have liberals and conservatives, Democrats and Republicans on both sides of this issue.
Walter O'Malley wins out with the Strange Bedfellow Partnership that supports him. He gets his site. He brings in his favorite architect from New York and builds what then became the most fabulous stadium of its time.
That's right. It really is an interesting story. O'Malley has an engineering background, unlike many other owners. And so he had an idea in his head of what he wanted in his dream stadium. He brings in the architect Emil Prager, who had already designed a smaller stadium for him at Vero Beach, Florida, in Dodgertown, which was the old Los Angeles Dodgers training center. Ground was scooped out so that the field was somewhat sunken. And that's what O'Malley wanted for Dodger Stadium as well. Now, if you sink the stadium into the ground and you build the stands instead of from the ground up, some of the stands are sort of, you know, below ground, basically. You make it easier for your fans to get to their seats. He also, of course, wanted plenty of parking, one of the reasons that he moved out in the first place. And what he was able to design in Dodger Stadium is a level parking arrangement where you were basically parking on the level where your seat was. So again, you were not climbing all the way up to the top from the bottom. And of course, no poles, and of course, beautiful vistas of the mountains and the downtown area. So Dodger Stadium for Walter O'Malley was what he had dreamed of doing his entire life. And that's really the reason that he moved from Brooklyn to Los Angeles. If he could have built that stadium in Brooklyn, he would have stayed. I think it's very clear, at least to me.
Dodger Stadium gets built. It's the marvel of its time. Over the decades, it's had to go through some renovations. It's become, you know, it fell behind other newer stadiums. But anyway, here it is. Now, the dream has been realized. There is a concentration of activity back in downtown Los Angeles, and there's also a concentration of traffic. And all that parking that was such an asset at the time now is a contributor to this, you know, massive congestion that now surrounds Dodger Stadium and is going to ratchet up no end this week, you know, as these games are played today, Tuesday, and tomorrow, Wednesday. So what about the downside of the realization of this dream?
Well, the downside of the realization of the dream, and as is so often the case in Los Angeles, is tied up with mass transit. Los Angeles had a functioning mass transit system in the 1930s. They chose to dismantle it, and Dodger Stadium is affected by that. As we know, there is no rail link to Dodger Stadium. Those Dodger fans who drive to the game are accustomed to sitting in traffic. It's only going to get worse. The team has tried to institute some public transportation alternatives. You can take a bus from Union Station, but it would be much better to have a rail line from Union Station that goes to Dodger Stadium. That is going to be the major challenge. In terms of downtown Los Angeles generally, it is a much more interesting and vibrant place now than it was in 1957 before Dodger Stadium was built. It is still a work in progress, however.
And one of the other interesting unintended consequences of the whole saga that produced Dodger Stadium is that there was that community in Chavez Ravine that had been moved from that neighborhood. It was bitterly contested. It remained a sore wound for that community. And yet, now what we see is that the most devoted fan base for the Dodgers in Los Angeles tends Latino.
That's yet another irony of this very complicated story. You would think, because of the lingering bitterness of the Chavez Ravine evictions, the Latino community would turn against the Dodgers, but that just has not happened. From what I can see, over the years, the most loyal Dodger fans are the Latino fans. They're the kind of fans who stuck with the team, let's say, during the McCourt years, when a lot of other fans didn't. So that's the irony. Sometimes you hold two seemingly contradictory ideas in your head at the same time, and sometimes that's how we get through our lives and get through our days. I think the Latino community in Los Angeles experiences both love for the Dodgers, but a lingering anger over what happened at Chavez Ravine.
You've been listening to Gerald Podair. He's professor of history at Lawrence University in Wisconsin, and he's author of City of Dreams, Dodger Stadium, and the Birth of Modern Los Angeles.
when I hit my last home run. Third base, Dodgers Stadium.
I'm Frances Anderton. You're listening to DNA. After this break, we're heading to Highland Park, where we're going to meet the designers of Superba, Oinkster and Counterculture. They're going to show us their makeover of an old Masonic lodge and explain their very provocative name.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
Back with DNA, I'm Frances Anderton.
We are at the Figueroa Lodge in Highland Park.
And Checker Hall, which is the restaurant. So it's a venue with a theater, two unique venues in one location.
And yeah, so we're in the finishing touches. They're testing the sound currently as we speak.
This is Catherine Johnson and Rebecca Rudolph, principals of a design studio in Glassell Park. Right now we're in an old Masonic lodge just off of Figueroa Street in Highland Park. We're upstairs from Good Girl Dinette. That's a Vietnamese restaurant and diner that this firm designed.
So there's Good Girl Dinette, there's a vintage clothing shop, there's a Cedillo's council office, and there's a bakery, Latin bakery also. Also on the third floor, above this space, there's a hip-hop producer up there. And so all those tenants, you know, are kind of feeding into the energy of the building, and they're staying here. And this project is now, you know, going to become something that has a lot of different cultural events that people can come to, from rock music to comedians and jazz performances and things like that.
You might have sampled Kathy and Rebecca's work at other buzzworthy eateries they've designed. Cool House Ice Cream Sandwiches, Burger Lords, Button Mash, The Oinkster, Counterculture, Superba, as well as graphics and products and other kind of spaces. They studied at the Experimental Southern California Institute of Architecture, or SIARC, and they met while working for architect Barbara Bester. 7 years ago, they founded a firm with what they call a badass approach to design and a provocative name you'll hear about shortly. Their spaces are practical, inventive, colourful and stylish, but without having a style you can put a label on.
If there's a philosophy behind what we do, it relates to kind of everyday life and accessibility and having people, you know, feel comfortable in the space and want to use it and like it and making it work for them, which also includes elements of delight and surprise and interesting space and proportion and all of these things.
So we've kept a lot of the historic touches, like the wallpaper in here is original, and then added some vibrant overlays. So there's sort of this old peachy tan floral wallpaper with this new vibrant grape.
And we really kept, you know, almost all of what was originally here. We made a few very small structural changes to accommodate sort of a contemporary use, but still keeping the, I guess, the spirit and the soul of what the space was, but being more open to the public.
There's another Masonic lodge that was turned fairly recently into a museum, and that's now the Marciano Collection. And there they really do have some very interesting and somewhat intriguing details left to them from that Masonic tenant. Yeah. Do you have the same here?
There's a lot of woodwork that's original, and then there's smaller details like brass pieces with Masonic symbols in them, and there's paintings in the lodge room, which is the big performance space, that are original. We placed a bar in the center of the room, and this bar is also somewhat in the symbol of a Masonic logo. It's a kind of a modified shape, but that alludes, you know, to the past and makes for interesting spaces and angles in the room as well.
As designers, It really is a challenge to create an environment that people feel comfortable, at home in, wanting to chat with their friends, etc., etc.
I mean, that's something that we think about a lot in our work in all of our projects, because I think something creating different types of seating is kind of a key component. So we have these taller booths over to the side where a group could gather. So it's almost like a little room over there. And then tucking in nooks, having different ways to sit, I think encourages people to come solo, groups, on a date. You know, we often look at, you know, the angles of backs of things too, so it's not quite too upright and proper, so people can feel like whether they're eating or drinking, the posture feels comfortable right away, so you're not sort of awkwardly perched on the edge of your seat.
So we should probably get back to the elephant in the room, which is you guys have a very fascinating and provocative name. In fact, it's a name that because I'm probably like antiquated, had a kind of a problem with myself. I really, really have admired your work for a long time, and I've kept thinking, I've got to talk to those ladies, they're so talented, but I can't quite get past their name. Tell us what that name is.
The name is Design Bitches, and there's a comma, and the comma is incredibly important because the comma changes the meaning of it. You know, to us, one, there's just a kind of a wit and an irreverence to it that we, when we first started out, was important to what we were doing because we felt like we take our work seriously, but not necessarily take ourselves so seriously. What we're doing is we're creating spaces for people to be in, you know, essentially that's the job, is that we're augmenting life, I guess you would say. And so that name has, for us, has to do with kind of turning it around and including the audience in it and saying, it's Design Bitches, and we're talking directly to
your audience.
Audience
is the bitches. Yeah.
Yep. But the bitches in the sense of like, hey bitches, it's not bitches in the sense of the word that might offend you, I guess. Or that's not the main meaning of it.
But at the same time, it does appear to be making some kind of comment or taking ownership about what was once a derogatory term for women. So it was kind of building gender into the name of the firm. I guess I was sort of fascinated by that because it's sort of, design is mute, you know, a building is mute. Does one need to have a slightly jarring name that infers something about identity in the name of an architecture firm?
I think I would say definitely doesn't need to be, and everybody's going to have a different approach. And even when we first started, we were working on projects totally self-driven, you know, art installations and self-motivated kind of projects that were not necessarily client-focused. So I would say starting an architecture firm with the intent of having, you know, this kind of name wasn't exactly the way that it started. That said, it's been really helpful for us because there's an attitude to the name. It helps attract a certain kind of client.
I think the interesting thing to me has been, over the course of the last 7-ish years, has been through that desire for this approach of sense of approachability and having a name like Design Bitches. When I take, you know, a check to the bank or I'm at the building department, there are women who I might receive it, you know, people who are older than me, or, you know, they're working a corporate job, or they're the accountant or the banker, and it starts actually a conversation. Like, they'll say, oh, Design Bitches, I got it right? And then they will ask, and so I have conversations about architecture all the time because of the name with people who know nothing about architecture, and I find that kind of delightful. When we first started, and I told my parents that we started this partnership and this practice, I didn't tell them the name at first. And my parents are not particularly, I wouldn't consider them uptight or close-minded in any way. But I think I had a moment of, what will my mom think about the using the word bitches? And then we got a card in the mail, like a little greeting card, and it said something like, what's up, bitches, inside, from my mom. And I thought, oh, all right. Apparently mom's on board.
Yeah.
And if she can be on board, you know,
everybody
could be.
It's sort of hip-hop. Do people ever say, but that's cultural appropriation?
I don't know. No, they haven't really said that. Although, I mean, I do love hip-hop.
now you are at an interesting stage in your career. In fact, this coming weekend, you're going to get an award from your peers, from AIALA, the Emerging Practice Award, which suggests that you are emerging and therefore probably moving into a new phase of your work. And that new phase might involve civic architecture, it might involve schools, hospitals, it might involve going to a whole nother scale. You know, if you get a call from the GSA, the General Services Administration, saying, apply for our courthouse, are you going to just carry on showing up at meetings saying, hi, we're design bitches? Or are you going to have to, are you going to have to consider your brand?
It's interesting, we actually have our very first academic cultural commerce coming together project actually here in Highland Park with Occidental College. We were hired as design bitches from them, and
we'll have to wait and see how it goes. So far we've been able to sort of slowly grow the practice and slowly grow the size of the projects that we're working on, and it seems to not have impeded us yet. If at some point it became an impediment, we might.
I think idealistically, it would be really nice if it sort of chopped down the meaning of that word so much that, you know, we were doing a large civic project and it no longer mattered.
So back to your emerging practice, what would be your dream project?
One of them would be some kind of public park project. We're getting into some projects that have a more cultural component to them, and then we're doing some education projects, but none of them are as open as a park is, where we kind of could work with, you know, urban planning and thinking about how people move through the city, and there's some built elements and some natural elements that would be really interesting to us.
You studied at SciArc. When SciArc first started, say, back in the 70s, LA for architects and designers truly felt like a frontier. They truly felt like they had an enormous amount of freedom. Nobody was watching. Land was cheap, etc., etc. Things have changed. LA has become a little more constrained. Do you think and do you feel it, and does it sometimes get in the way of ideas?
Yes, the craziness of the real estate market definitely makes, you know, it's a challenge to get anything built at all. So that's just something that we're fighting. You know, we're constantly fighting, and it's getting more and more expensive. There's also, of course, there's a lot more, you know, code constraints, and it adds a lot of time and it adds a lot of layers to the work that we do that maybe, you know, architects didn't have to deal with as much of that.
Right. I mean, I think even over the course of like the time that we've been practicing, I can see a huge shift in this kind of wild west of experimentation. I still think that there, because LA is a creative city, there's an openness to experimentation that doesn't exist as much in some other cities perhaps. But I think that maybe that might feed part of our small like small rebellions of like using weird materials in little ways where we can is our current way within a budget of how to actually kind of break rules.
And lastly, tell us when this bar and restaurant opens.
They're having their first show on November 3rd. It's a benefit for Puerto Rico, and it's going to be Ty Siegel and a bunch of Eagle Rock bands.
Very soon.
Yeah.
Well, Catherine Johnson, Rebecca Rudolph, it's great to talk to you. Thank you.
Thank you so much for having us.
Yeah, thanks so much. It's been a pleasure.
I'm Frances Anderton. That's it for today's DNA. Avishai Artsy is DNA's producer. JC Swatek mixed this episode. Special thanks to Jason Groman. And thank you very much for listening. Stay tuned for The World, coming up next.